From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen in for Terry Gross. During the 1992 presidential election, candidate Clinton promised to end welfare as we know it. This month, President Clinton is expected to sign a bill that will dramatically scale back the welfare program. Jason DePaul writes about welfare and other social policy issues for the New York Times. DePaul traces the program back to its origin some 60 years ago and looks at how public attitudes have changed in the last decade and looks at why changing the welfare system doesn't get to the deeper problem, poverty itself. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews an American performing arts festival that is attracting international groups, the Lincoln Center Festival 96. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Michigan voters rejected two prominent incumbents in primary elections yesterday. Republican voters also selected an anti-abortion candidate to run for the U.S. Senate seat. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Three-term Democratic Congresswoman Barbara Rose Collins, who's under investigation for alleged misuse of campaign funds, lost by a wide margin in Detroit's 15th congressional district. She was defeated by State Representative Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick. The other incumbent ousted by Michigan primary voters was Republican Oakland County Prosecutor Richard Thompson. Thompson's unsuccessful attempts to prosecute assisted suicide advocate Jack Kevorkian were made an issue in the race by winning candidate, attorney David Gorsica. In the Republican U.S. Senate primary, talk show host Ronna Romney used the organizational support of anti-abortion groups to defeat Detroit businessman Jim Nicholson. Romney will face three-term Democratic Senator Carl Levin in November. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
In other state primary results, GOP Kansas Congressman Dick Brownback defeated Senator Sheila Fromm in the race for Bob Dole's former seat. Fromm had been appointed to replace Dole in June. She previously was the Kansas lieutenant governor. Kansas Representative Pat Roberts crushed three opponents in the race to fill retiring Kansas Senator Nancy Kassebaum's seat. In Georgia, Atlanta businessman Guy Milner defeated Johnny Isaacson for the GOP Senate nod. He'll square off against Democrat Max Cleland, former head of the Federal Veterans Administration. Both Georgians are vying to succeed retiring Democrat Sam Nunn. Syrian President Hafez al-Assad met today with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. They discussed the stalled Middle East peace process. NPR Suni Khalid reports from Alexandria, Egypt.
There will be no separate peace for Syria and Lebanon with Israel, Syrian President Assad told reporters after he met with Mubarak at the presidential palace in Alexandria. The Syrian leader added that prospects for a comprehensive peace do not look good. With his statement, Assad publicly rejected the so-called Lebanon First proposal offered by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Under the plan, Israel and Syria would withdraw their troops from Lebanon in return for a guarantee from the Lebanese government against Hezbollah attacks on northern Israel. The offer would leave unchanged the status of the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. Syria is demanding that Israel's new government commit itself to a complete troop pullout of the Golan Heights before it will resume formal peace talks. I'm Suni Khalid in Alexandria.
The Naval Academy expelled 15 midshipmen for drug offenses. This ends the worst drug scandal at the military academy in more than 20 years. All but one of the midshipmen were found to have used LSD and marijuana. On Wall Street, the Dow's up a fraction of a point at 5,696. This is NPR. A team of scientists has found strong circumstantial evidence that life once existed on Mars. The evidence is contained in a meteorite that landed on Earth about 13,000 years ago. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
The meteorite landed in an ice field in Antarctica, where it was discovered 12 years ago. Scientists believe the meteorite came from Mars because of its unusual chemical composition that exactly mirrors what space probes have found on the red planet. There wasn't any frozen life form inside the 4.5-billion-year-old chunk of rock. Instead, it has certain chemical and physical properties that suggest that at least a primitive form of life may have once been present on Mars. One of the hints is that the meteorite contains molecules called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. While these can be produced by the same physical processes that occur when new stars form, they can also be produced by living organisms like bacteria. News of the discovery first appeared in the trade magazine Space News. A complete description of the research will appear in next week's issue of the journal Science. This is Joe Palka in Washington.
Uganda says it's joined Kenya and Tanzania in imposing economic sanctions on Burundi. The move is an effort to topple the new Tutsi military junta led by Major Pierre Buyoya. Analysts say the move is significant because Uganda is seen as a key supporter of the Tutsi armies in Burundi and neighboring Rwanda. A consumer watchdog group is warning people to beware of hidden fats in foods. The Center for Science in the Public Interest says the saturated fat listed on nutrition labels doesn't tell the whole story. CSPI says people need to know about trans fats. Trans fats are created when vegetable oil is hardened by a process called hydrogenation. The group says trans fats raise the levels of bad cholesterol in the blood and increase the risk of heart attack. The group is urging restaurants to switch to liquid vegetable oils, which have no trans fats. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. Last week, Congress passed welfare reform legislation that ends a program started more than 60 years ago by President Roosevelt that provided guaranteed support for poor women and their children. Among the provisions in the new bill are requirements that a recipient cannot receive benefits for more than 5 years in their lifetime, that every head of household must work within 2 years in order to receive benefits, that legal immigrants who come to the country will not be entitled to food stamps or SSI payments. The bill goes to the president, who has promised to sign it. Under the legislation crafted by Congress, aid to families with dependent children, AFDC, will be dismantled as a federal entitlement, and responsibility for the current recipients will go to the states. Each state will be given a block grant to administer their programs and may experiment with the kinds of services they want to offer. Jason DeParl has been covering welfare and poverty for The New York Times for 10 years. He's currently a staff writer for The New York Times Magazine. The current welfare system has few supporters, but DeParl says that it has done some good.
No one likes the welfare system. The people who pay for it don't like it. The people who run it don't like it. And the people who exist on it don't like it. But there's a common assumption in the country right now that nothing could be worse. I'm not sure that's the case. I think the failures of the welfare system are on full and constant display, but the successes tend to be somewhat invisible. The successes can be a bowl of cereal, new school clothes, a place to live that's not in a homeless shelter, a temporary period of getting by between the loss of jobs. I don't think we see very often the successes of the welfare system. They're ameliorative successes more often than they're transformative ones. But sure, it does do a lot of good.
The system was designed originally as a temporary measure providing assistance to a family, a woman and her children. Would you say that there is a sizable portion of women who have used that program as intended, as a way to help them through some rough times and help them get back on their feet?
Well, actually, I'm not sure it was designed as a temporary form of assistance. I think originally it was designed as something more permanent because it was designed as a kind of widow's pension. I mean, the typical recipient, the current AFDC system, Aid to Families with Dependent Children, was passed in 1935 as part of the Social Security Act, and it was meant to provide a small widow's benefit. Basically, the average person that the lawmakers had in mind at that time was a West Virginia miner's widow. Her husband had gone down in the mines, had been killed. There was no expectation that that woman then could go out and provide for her children. So this was a small benefit, a small pension for them to get by on. Of course, that original purpose has absolutely nothing in common with the 12 million people who now receive AFDC. So it's a system that, you know, was designed for a very different purpose in a very different age. I think you can look at the current welfare system and you really have one program serving two very different sets of circumstances. If we had started from scratch in 1996, we probably would have come up with two different welfare systems. One would be a more temporary kind of unemployment insurance or divorce insurance. The kind of person I have in mind when I'm saying this is somebody got married right out of high school, had a baby, is divorced in her early 20s, has one or two kids, now has to go out and go to some kind of junior college or training institute, find a way to support herself and her family with a little bit of child support and get back on her feet. There are lots and lots of people who come on the welfare system and use it for precisely that purposes. They are on leave in less than 2 years, get a little bit of training, get a job, and they're off. There's a whole second set of people who come on having never been married and have much more severe skills deficit, haven't finished high school, haven't been married, grown up in poverty. They come on and tend to stay on much longer. For those people, it's become a long-term maintenance program, and I think that's what the public has in mind when it says it was never designed or never meant to be that.
There is an assumption in this piece of legislation that if you remove the safety net, everyone can get a job and support themselves and their family. Is there any evidence that that will work?
Everybody wants to see the welfare system move to one that supports work. I think there are three, no one's against the idea of work. And that actually is a change from, say, a decade ago. I do think when I, at the very earliest time when I started covering this issue, and really a little bit before my time, I've been on this story probably for 10 years now, there was, going back in the late 70s, early 80s, some thought that, you know, we just shouldn't really require single mothers to work. They're better off at home with their children. They're better off spending full time with their mothers and being mothers. That it was unreasonable to expect them to go out and take one of these low wage jobs. I don't think you hear that very much anymore. I don't think you really hear it at all, even among the most liberal advocates or the people who are seen as the defenders of the system. Now, there are three questions I think you can ask about the 4 million welfare families on the subject of work. One is, can they find jobs? The second is, can they keep the jobs? And the third is, what will their lives be like if they do? Will the jobs be enough to lift them out of poverty? Let's take them one at a time. Can they find jobs? A lot of them can. Certainly not all. I mean, you're talking about right now there's somewhat more than 4 million families receiving AFDC. 2 million of those, if not more, are really pretty severely disadvantaged people. You're talking about people functionally illiterate, often have had drug or alcohol abuse problems. It's hard to get a good handle on those numbers, but a third to two-thirds, depending on how you would define it, would have that. Some severe incidences of mental health problems, chronic depression. Who wants to go out and hire them? What kind of employees are they going to make? What kind of remedial training do they need? There's some severe questions there about how well these people are going to be able to find jobs. I think the bigger question, even in finding jobs, is keeping them. I spent a couple weeks actually living with a woman who had just gotten off of AFDC. This was a couple of years ago in Chicago. She had found a job as a cook in a homeless shelter. She lived on the far south side of Chicago. She had to be at work on the north side of Chicago at 6 o'clock in the morning. She had 4 kids. So the reason I moved in with her is I wanted to see how she got there by 6 o'clock in the morning. What was her morning routine like? Well, she got up at 3:30 in the morning. She left the house at 5 o'clock in the morning, drove the kids across Chicago, dropped them at her mother's house at 5:30, then drove north, got to the homeless shelter at 6, cooked from 6 to 2, left at 2, went back, got the kids, got home. It was a very tenuous existence. I mean, one thing could go wrong. Her radiator blows, her car goes bad, and the whole thing falls apart. These are not jobs where, you know, if I have some problems at home and I can't get it to the paper that week, everyone says, well, do your best, work from home, see what you can do, you'll make it up to us. That doesn't happen if you're a short order cook in a homeless shelter.
Let me just stop you there, though. Mm-hmm. Why did she do it? Why was she so determined to go to work?
Well, it's a good question because financially we sat down and tried to figure out was she better off financially when she was on AFDC or when she was working. A lot of it, you know, it gets complicated because she'd get some tax credits, but her food stamps would go down, but she had more child care costs. When you cost her that out, she really wasn't ahead financially. I mean, if she was, it was by $5 or $10 a week. Why does she do it? I think she had hopes that she could take that first step and get into a second step, that she might have been earning, I think she was earning $6 an hour at the homeless shelter, you know, maybe that would be the first step to an $8 an hour job, or from 8 to 10. And in her case, it didn't turn out that way, and she didn't make it. She's back on AFDC. But the storyline, you know, I found her in the fall of 1994. I think the story would have been much the same whether it had been 1991 or 1990 or 1989. There's the idea that welfare recipients should go to work. Well, let me tell you, Mary Ann Moore, that was her name, has had more jobs than I'll ever have. Mm. I mean, she had some of the most exotic jobs. She had sold nuts at O'Hare Airport. She had worn roller skates and skated around a big Sears catalog in downtown Chicago, pulling merchandise from the warehouse. She had fried eggs. She had driven trucks. She had been a security guard in the middle of the parking lot in the middle of the Chicago winter. She had done all mindless variety of jobs. The problem for her was never finding a job. The problem was always keeping it, because a child would get sick, the car would break down, a fight would erupt with a boyfriend. And the whole thing, she'd be sort of back starting over again, which is where she is now.
Well, what you're describing is how difficult it is for very determined women to get off of AFDC and to try to work in the kind of chaotic lives that many of them live. Do you think she's a fairly good example of someone who could, and perhaps even with the right supports, could make it off of welfare, but obviously needing more than what she got in the past?
I think, to be intellectually honest about this, I would say that that either side of this debate could point toward Mary Ann Moore as a vindication of their view. Let me give you the two sides, and then I'll give you as objectively as I can, and then I'll tell you where my own subjective interpretation would be. I think the right, the people who say that welfare itself is a lure, would look at someone like Mary Ann Moore and say, look, she's obviously competent. She can get up at 3:30 in the morning. She can go to work. She's smart, she's intelligent, she's resourceful. If she didn't have AFDC to fall back on, then the next time the car breaks down or she gets sick or the kids, she'll just find a way. She'll without welfare, welfare would be is luring her away from the marketplace. It's eroding her commitment. If we take it away, it shows, look, she's healthy, she can go make it on her own. The other view would be, look, we don't need time limits. This woman's out trying to find a job anyways. She's plenty motivated. Her problem isn't welfare. It isn't this safety net beneath her. Her problem is she's poor, and she doesn't have the support she needs. She doesn't have the child care. She doesn't have transportation. She doesn't, and the job she gets doesn't make enough to pay her more to lift her out of poverty. She can work full-time and still be below the poverty line. So Mary Ann Moore is not an example of problems in the welfare system. She's an example of the poverty system. Those would be the two varying interpretations you could draw out of her life. My view would be more towards the latter, that the real issues in her life tend to be more poverty issues. But I do think there is the welfare system hasn't helped any. It's never really required anything. It's been a little too easy for her to give up and go back on it. So I'm three quarters in the camp that says her problem is a poverty problem. But I do think that there's at least a missed opportunity with the welfare system to help her.
Do you think there's anything in this new legislation which would help other women like her to get out of welfare and be able to find some success, even at poor-paying jobs?
Let me back up just one second. You asked me earlier if I thought there was anything good to come out of the welfare system or out of welfare itself. While we're on Mary Ann Moore, it's worth noting that I think there's something very good that's come out of what's otherwise a very disreputable program in the case of Mary Ann Moore, and that's the progress of her 16-year-old son, Marcello. When I first met him, he was 14 years old. After the story that we ran in the New York Times Magazine appeared, through a complicated series of events, he wound up winning a scholarship to a boarding school in Chicago. In Colorado, and where he's now thriving. In fact, today he's finishing his second semester. He's given a presentation out there this afternoon. Welfare enabled the welfare system, the discredited, disreputable welfare system, enabled him to have shelter for most of the time. The family was occasionally homeless. To have a minimal amount of food, to have some clothing, to keep that family intact, albeit in its incredibly chaotic state. And there's a very strong bond between Marcello and Mary Ann, even though at one point, you know, they were living together in a homeless shelter. And the safety net, tattered as it is, somehow managed to create enough of an environment for him to get on his feet and get off and get out of Chicago now and to be able to thrive in a boarding school. So that's an invisible success. I think when you look at the Moore family, you think, geez, here's Mary Ann. She's been on welfare for on and off for more than 15 years. This is obviously the system isn't worked. Or you could look at Marcello, who at age 16 is now the house leader of his cabin at a boarding school and doing remarkably well.
Jason DeParl is our guest, and he's a staff writer for the New York Times, where he's been writing about poverty and welfare. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jason DeParl, and he's a staff writer for the New York Times. President Clinton vetoed two previous welfare reform proposals. Why do you think he's supporting this one?
You have seen in the past 4 years the remarkable evolution of a slogan. The slogan was End Welfare as We Know It, and it made its national debut 4 years ago during Bill Clinton's first presidential campaign. It's a remarkably potent phrase and I think a mostly misunderstood one. When Bill Clinton, I think most of the public and certainly the Republican Congress has focused on the first two words, end it. I think what Bill Clinton initially had in mind was the as we know it rejoinder. He was talking about a program that would, yes, impose time limits, but also offer people more job training, more child care, more health insurance, and in the end, in the event they could not find a job on their own, some sort of last resort public works job. His program, as when he finally presented it to the Congress in June of 1994, would have spent an extra $10 billion over the current program, say over 5 years. In the bill that passed, the Republican Congress, 2 years later, cut $55 billion. So it went from a program that would have spent $10 billion and guaranteed you a job in the end if you couldn't find one on your own, to a program that cut $55 billion and guaranteed you nothing. I mean, it became, if not 180 degrees different than what Bill Clinton proposed, about 175 degrees different. I think in the end he allowed his enemies to define the meaning of that slogan. He threw it out there. It had this kind of great resonance. It became his most potent promise. He vetoed two previous bills that had welfare changes in them. He was facing a spate of Republican attack ads from now until November as having reneged on that promise, and in the end, they came to define it for him.
Even though he's certainly gone on record describing what he meant by as we know it, and many people have looked at the welfare system, have come to the conclusion that in order to get people out of welfare and get them working is going to require more money. It seems that the facts, the evidence, would back up the president.
Well, you know, he did describe it in his typical elaborate detail during the 92 campaign, but then he kind of dropped it. I mean, it disappeared in 1993 as he was focusing on his health care legislation. And when he finally came up with and presented it in the June of 1994, it was late in the congressional session. Everyone was leaving to go campaign. His political clout was at a low. He never really tried to push it through the Congress. Then by November 94, you had a new Congress, and all of 1995, certainly the first half of 1995, Bill Clinton was strictly on defense. And it wasn't until the end of 1995 when he began to assert himself again, and he was doing it on other issues, on Social Security and Medicare, certainly not on welfare. So I think having thrown out a phrase like end welfare, he really didn't stay with it and try to push through his own definition of what it meant. And the result, I think, was very disillusioning and bittering even for some prominent members of the administration. It's remarkable. This is a little bit of inside baseball here, but if you go down the list of the people who are in the Clinton administration and were just, I think, terribly disillusioned by the way this all came out. I mean, you've got Mrs. Clinton herself, who was a former head of the Children's Defense Fund. The Secretary of Health and Human Services, Donna Shalala, was a head of the Children's Defense Fund. Henry Cisneros, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, had to go out and try to sell these immigrant cuts to the Hispanic community. Peter Edelman is Marion Wright Edelman's, the current head of the Children's Defense Fund. Her husband is an official in the Department of Health and Human Services. David Elwood, the godfather, intellectual godfather of time-limited welfare, had come in the Clinton administration to try to devise this plan. In the end, he was back at Harvard writing op-eds urging the president to veto it. I mean, all the people who were in on the initial exciting stages of what Bill Clinton might mean, in the end, were trying to put the brakes on and saying, no, don't do this.
So did Clinton look to his pollsters for the answer then?
Well, there's a debate about that, I think. To be fair to the president, he may actually think that this legislation is better than most of his advisors did. I don't think we can pretend that he wasn't taking account of the politics. The politics were, there was clearly very little to gain politically by vetoing this bill, and much to gain politically by signing it. He really was under severe political pressure to sign it. But I wouldn't say necessarily that that was the only reason he did. Remember, Bill Clinton was a governor. Bill Clinton does understand welfare far better than any other president. And he may actually believe more than the people around him who haven't had his experience at the state level that governors know best. I think that is an ideology that he adheres to, and a precept that he believes in.
Jason DePauw writes about welfare and social policy issues for The New York Times and is a staff writer for The New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more about welfare and poverty in the second half of the show. I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The future of America's poor children. We continue our conversation with New York Times writer Jason DePauw about how poor children will fare under the new welfare reforms. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a summer performance arts festival in New York that's attracting international groups.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're talking about welfare reform with New York Times Magazine staff writer Jason DeParle. He's been covering social policy issues for the New York Times for a decade. Last week, Congress voted to end aid to families with dependent children, AFDC, as a federal entitlement and turn the responsibility for services for poor women and their children over to the states. Well, let's talk about children because the United States has the highest rate of child poverty in the industrialized world. Critics of this legislation have predicted that without a federal entitlement, children will go hungry. Supporters say that's nonsense. No state, no governor is going to let their children, their residents, starve. How do you think children will fare under these series of reforms?
I think it's an issue that that attracts hyperbole on all sides. Ed Koch wrote in the New York Post that children are going to starve. Look, I don't think children starve in America, but I do think children can go hungry. And I think when you take $55 billion out of a set of government programs for people who are already desperately poor, it's naive or wishful thinking to think that their chaotic lives aren't going to become a little bit more chaotic and painful than they already are. You look at Marianne Moore's budget. If you take $5 out, she feels it. And I think that's what's going to happen to lots of people. And it very well may be a kind of invisible thing where taxpayers and outside people don't know what it means to go without an extra box of cereal. But I do think that's the kind of thing that is going to happen for many people.
This legislation shifts the responsibility to the states, making welfare the responsibility of state government and giving them the authority to experiment with these programs as they see fit. Looking around the country, are you concerned, as critics of this program are concerned, that there will be a, quote, dive to the bottom, that the states will compete with each other to offer the least amount of services because of the sheer expense involved with trying to deal with this issue of poverty?
You know, yes, I am. One interesting, I went up to the Senate on Thursday afternoon to listen to the final hours of the welfare debate, and one by one, you know, two dozen senators came to the floor to give their 5 or 10 minute speech about it. One of the things that struck me about the debate was that very little of it was about the welfare bill itself. I mean, very little of it was about how much money we need for childcare or whether we need to change the time limit from 2 years to 3 years or what the available evidence said. It was all about, it was almost religious in its focus on ideology. It was about family and honor and decency and work. It was about these kind of these values and these themes, and people on both sides, people who were for and people who were against it. And people were getting up and telling family stories. You know, they were getting up and saying, well, my grandparents came here. Tom Daschle did this. My grandparents were immigrants, and under this bill, they would be denied food. And someone else got up and said, my parents came and they made it without any government help, and that's America. You know, this is such a powerful issue because it involves at a kind of subterranean level family, work, sexual behavior, race. It really taps into these very explosive issues, and this gets back to what you're asking about the states. I mean, part of the ideological furor here is states will not let their children starve, on one side saying, and the other side saying, this is a federal responsibility. The federal government cannot abandon its children. You really have this welfare debate taking place on two levels. You have this one ideological, and it really is, I mean, it's literally a conversation about each other's mother. You know, my mother raised me this way, and people are on the Senate floor saying these things about each other's parents and grandparents. That's a powerful set of arguments, ultimately not very meaningful when you get down to the level of running the program. When you get down to the level that you're asking out, what will states actually do? Well, the Congressional Budget Office says that the current bill, there's $12 billion less in the current bill needed than the law requires to run these work programs. So I think, you know, can states run a program on $12 billion less than they need? No, I think they'll cut corners, and ultimately, that means that families go without a bowl of cereal now and then.
Well, states have been experimenting with welfare reforms, most notably Michigan under Governor John Engler, and some other states as well, New Jersey, parts of California. Have you had a chance to look at some of these programs to see if indeed they have been successful at all and at what cost?
Sure. I've been to lots of programs, and the question is always, what do you mean by success?
Sure.
That's the endless loophole when you talk about social policy programs. The program that is generally regarded as the most successful welfare experiment in the country is in Riverside, California. It's a welfare-to-work program. The statewide program is called GAIN, and they tried it in six or seven different counties in California. The one with the best results was in Riverside, which is a community an hour or two east of L.A. The philosophy of the GAIN program is get a job, any job, even a bad job. Don't go to school. Don't get education. Basically, when you've got people who've been long-term welfare dependent, the idea at one point was, well, look, they don't have any skills. They need training. So before you can send them out in the workplace, we need to get them some education, get them some training, give them a couple of years in the classroom. Then they can get a better job. GAIN took the opposite approach and said, look, most of the reason that people came wound up on welfare to begin with is that they failed in a classroom setting. These are people who, for whatever reason, don't work well in that environment. Mm-hmm. We want to just get them a job, get them some skills, get them some on-the-job training, get them acculturated to the workplace, make sure they understand what the demands of the job are. Then maybe down the line, 3-4 years later, they'll be more directed, more committed, and they might benefit more from a training program.
And how have they done?
They've had the best success. They've gotten more people off of welfare than any other evaluated program. By evaluated, I mean a scientifically evaluated, where you have a control group of people who weren't in the program compared to people who were in the program. So on the one hand, it's a big success. On the other hand, I don't want to use the word failure, but if it's a success, it's a humbling one. The average person after 2 years in the GAIN program had a monthly earned income of $280 a month. Now, this is everybody on average, so some people had zero earnings. Not everybody in the program found and kept a job, so 2 years after they started, some people had no earnings at all. You know, other people might have been making $1,000 a month, but when you added it all together, averaged it out, it's $280 a month. Well, it's better. I think it was something like 30% more than the people who hadn't been in the program. So it certainly raised their earnings substantially. But is it what the public has in mind when they say getting people off of welfare? Is it what the public realm would qualify as a success? I think there's reasons to be worried about that.
Well, I know part of the particular legislation has to do with unmarried teenage parents, and that if they're under 18, they must stay in school and live with an adult in order to receive AFDC payments. Does that answer any problems for you? Does that provide a safety net, a support for a young mother and her child?
I think that it depends on what's going on in the family. I mean, in some cases, requiring young mothers to stay at home could be actually putting them in an abusive or dangerous situation. Depending on what's going on in the house, if there's severe conflict, say, with the mother, or what might be more common, with the mother's boyfriend, then you might not want that young family in the house. But nobody thinks that welfare should become a system that encourages people at age 16, 17, and 18 with no visible means of support and no without the benefits of marriage to go out and have a child and move out on your own. It's never meant to be that.
Why do you think Congress wanted to focus on legal immigrants withdrawing support for SSI and food stamps, and I believe health insurance in some instances? Why target this population, you think?
Well, the good reason would be that there has been a lot of abuse in these programs. SSI in particular, there's been in the past 5 years, I think, a kind of network or subculture that's grown up as a way of getting around the rules, and people are bringing immigrants, legal immigrants, are bringing over often their parents legally and then signing them up for SSI and for Medicaid in a way that circumvents the intent of any of these laws. And I think most people would agree, the traditions of being an immigrant, which is that you came to this country because it offered opportunity, not because it offered SSI and Medicaid. Mm. So there has been some abuse, and there is, I think, reason to try to crack down on it. But you know, did the Congress go too far? I think you have to. Oh, this welfare bill came under the guise of deficit reduction. It saved $55 billion over the next 6 years. None of the other deficit reduction plans passed. No one's now going. In fact, Bob Dole wants to go the other way on affluent Social Security recipients. There's been nothing done to restrain the growth of Medicare. There's been nothing done to restrain the growth of Social Security, even when those programs, even for the portion of the population that's the most affluent and benefits from those programs. So I think what happened with legal immigrants is that they were a politically powerless group of people, and you're seeing an income redistribution, $55 billion away from the poorest Americans so that the affluent and the middle class won't be asked to sacrifice.
We're talking to New York Times staff writer Jason DeParle about poverty and the new welfare reform legislation. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to New York Times staff writer Jason DeParle. You've been covering poverty for about a decade now. How are you going to cover these changes in legislation? How do you want to focus your attention and your readers' attention on this issue of welfare reform and poverty as these pieces of legislation evolve?
You know, I was thinking about that on Thursday as I was sitting up in the Senate gallery and in the hour or two before the vote, I was feeling a little sad that this story, which I've found very captivating for the last 4 years, is kind of coming to an end. And then it occurred to me, you know, geez, it's not coming to an end at all. This is really the beginning. The passage of the legislation is simply the preamble. We've got now comes the real event. There's all kinds of things to focus on. I mean, you want to look at state governments. How are they? 50 states now have to set up programs or adapt the current program to the law. It'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. Which ones go the way of Wisconsin, which is spending more money in trying to create some public jobs, or which ones will simply cut and offer a program even stingier than the one there is. Very interested in how this affects the social workers and the administrators, and most interested in all is how it affects the average AFDC recipient, most of whom may not even know this has passed. I'd be very interested to know. I was kind of debating with some friends, you know, do you think 1 in 10 people on AFDC knows this has happened? Or I'm not sure, you know, 1 in 10 knows who Bob Dole is or Newt Gingrich. It'll be most interesting of all to see how this plays out in their lives.
I feel sort of odd asking this question, but do you think Americans hate poor people?
You shouldn't feel odd asking that question. It's a very good question, and it's let me give you a simple answer and a more complicated answer.
Okay.
No.
But the
simple answer is no. If you asked it only slightly differently, do Americans hate welfare recipients? I'd be more inclined to say yes. I mean, hate is a strong word. I'm not sure that, certainly there's a strong dislike of welfare recipients. But there's no dislike at all of poor children. I mean, there's a great amount of concern about poor children. And that's the paradox of covering welfare. And it goes back again to this question of who wound up winning the definitional award. This didn't become a debate about poor children. It became a debate about welfare. And that's why I think it took the turn it did, in which you know, budgets were slashed and rhetoric was escalated and the rules were toughened and all those kinds of things. The difficulty, of course, is that it's the same. You're talking about the same thing. You know, it's welfare recipients and poor children. It's, you know, the reason we have the welfare is because of the poor children. The two are intricately tied. Every now and then I'll see somebody get up on the floor of the Senate and say, I am going to crack down on welfare recipients, but nothing should be done to hurt their children, so we'll just take away the mother's money. Well, and this is a fraud, of course. I mean, there's one budget. When you take away Marianne Moore's money, you're taking away Marcello Moore's money. And the impulse to take away the money of irresponsible people on welfare is entirely understandable. Look, I've spent more than a decade in and out of households, and you see things. You see wonderful, at times wonderful people trying to do the best under terrible circumstances, and at times you see very irresponsible people whose own irresponsibility is the reason that they're in that circumstances. I mean, I come out of households often, sometimes myself, thinking, geez, these people are not, this woman does not try to take care of her kids. She's not doing anything. She has a real sense of entitlement. I mean, it's all jumbled up together, the terrible suffering of some of these children, instances of irresponsibility on the parts of parents, and also instances of real courage and devotion at times on the parts of parents. The other thing, let me give one more type of answer to your question. Your question was, do Americans hate poor people? I don't think we can underestimate the extent to which we're having a kind of coded conversation about race. And I think the word welfare evokes minority population, and minorities there are about as many black people as white people on AFDC. But of course, that means black people are disproportionately likely to be on AFDC. And the whole welfare debate is also at times, not always, but often at times, a coded conversation about race. And yeah, in that case, I think there is some racial animus playing out amidst all the other complicated things that are playing out.
You talked about a woman that you profiled in the New York Times Magazine, Mary Ann Moore, as someone who struggled to get off of welfare and has gone back and forth, held a series of jobs. And I wonder if it's possible to use her as an example of how to help someone like Mary Ann Moore. You described the kind of missed opportunities in the current welfare system. What would be enough, you think, to really get her on her feet?
I don't know that there's any of us really know what to do to get a 35-year-old woman like Mary Ann back on her feet. I think what we really need to do is look toward Mary Ann's kids and say, Mary Ann's life is half over. She's made the decisions she's made. The mold of her life is already cast. But she's got four kids, and what's going to happen with their lives? The oldest one, the one I know best, is Marcello. I do think that there was one government program that very much damaged his life, and the big success in his life is getting out from the deleterious effects of that government program. But it wasn't welfare. In his case, it was public housing. It was the fact that he grew up in Cabrini Green, one of the major public housing high-rises in Chicago.
And a very dangerous place.
He grew up in an incredibly dangerous place where everybody around him was poor, and there was terrific pressure on joining a gang. The biggest thing that's happened in Marcello's life is that he got out of Cabrini Green. He got out of it to Estes Park, Colorado, which, if your listeners have been there,
it's a beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, he must. Sometimes I wish I could be inside his brain and you know, hear what he thought the first day he saw Estes Park. Yeah. He didn't know where Colorado was. He had it confused with California before he went there. So I think that you know, if there's one thing that I wish government anti-poverty policy would focus on, it would be finding every success case that I've come across in the decade that I've covered this has involved somebody physically separating themselves from an area of concentrated poverty like Cabrini Green and getting somewhere else, whether it's a boarding school or the army or the suburbs. There's a program in Chicago called the Gautreaux Assisted Housing Programs, which helps inner city residents move out to the suburbs. It's getting away from these areas of concentrated poverty and concentrated violence. If I could choose a direction, I'd like to see the government put its efforts and its ingenuity. It would be there, not in welfare itself.
Well, Jason DeParle, thanks very much for joining us on Fresh Air today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jason DeParle is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. This is Fresh Air. In a time of stringent cutbacks for the arts, Lincoln Center, under the directorship of former New York Times music critic John Rockwell, has spent $8.5 million on a three-week international arts festival, which concludes Sunday. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz spent last weekend in New York attending performances.
Every year, New York City used to proclaim itself a summer festival. For the past 3 weeks, it really was. Lincoln Center Festival 96 presented some of the most admired companies and controversial productions in the world. Like Ocean, the last joint effort in the 50-year partnership between John Cage, the late guru of chance music, and Merce Cunningham, the perhaps greater guru of modern dance. Ocean took place outdoors, after dark. The audience surrounded a circular stage to see 15 beautiful dancers in dark blues, greens, purples, and startling coral, buffeted by imaginary tides and supporting each other in some of Cunningham's most poignant balances, while 112 live musicians surrounded the audience and the lights of New York surrounded the theater. When the 77-year-old Cunningham hobbled onto the stage for his ovation, it was as if the dance had all taken place inside his head. Then there was a new work that tried to recreate what happens within everyone's head, Brain Opera by MIT's electronic music pioneer Todd Machover. For the first time, I thought his interactive electronic gizmos had more substance than most of the music itself. 84 free performances were packed. And good luck finding a ticket for Dublin's Gate Theatre, which is performing all 19 stage works of Samuel Beckett together for the first time in America. For me, the centerpiece of the festival was avant-garde director Robert Wilson's Houston Grand Opera production of what I think is the great American opera, Virgil Thomson and Gertrude Stein's Four Saints in three acts. I was hoping Wilson's eccentric and elegant visuals might illuminate Stein's no-nonsense nonsense, or Thomson's radiant spirituals, hymn tunes, and social dances. But they rarely meshed. A director needs to lead the audience through the verbal and musical mazes of this piece, not set up more barriers, though a few moments captured the right spirit, like a flock of white cut-out sheep suddenly rising from the stage. Yet I can't remember which music was playing when that took place. Still, the conductor, Dennis Russell Davies, built Thomson's glorious and spunky ensembles into ecstatic climaxes, and Sanford Sylvan as St. Ignatius sang with the profound simplicity and sincerity that is at the heart of this opera. Every word seemed to mean something to him, so it meant something to us. In some ways, though, it didn't matter that not everything worked. All over New York, people were excited about music and theater and dance. How much of that $8.5 million price tag was it worth just to be able to stroll down Broadway and overhear people arguing about Gertrude Stein?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Lincoln Center Festival 96 ends this weekend with a tribute to Yehudi Menuhin. Here's baritone Sanford Sylvan singing from Four Saints in three acts.
Pigeons on the grass, alas. Short, longer grass, short. Longer, longer, shorter, yellow grass. Pigeons, large pigeons on the shorter, longer, yellow grass. Alas, pigeons on the grass. If they were not pigeons on the grass, alas, what were they? Cannot cry if the pigeon on the grass, alas, can, alas, and to pass the pigeon on the grass, alas, and the magpie in the sky, on the sky, and to try, alas, on the grass, alas, the pigeon on the grass, the pigeon on the grass, and alas. Foundationally, marvelously, aboundingly, illimitably, with it as a circumstance. Fundamentally and saints, fundamentally and saints, and fundamentally and saints.
Audrey Bentham is Fresh Air's technical director, Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant, and Rena Bander is our researcher. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscoane.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, former Republican political consultant Ed Rollins. Now retired, Rollins has written his autobiography, Bare Knuckles and Back Rooms. It traces his rise through the campaigns to become one of America's most powerful political handlers. I'm Marty Moscoane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.